This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating from station WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And over the weekend, there was a most remarkable piece of investigative journalism done by our colleagues over at the United Nations, the Inner City Press. This organization obtained a secret or internal United Nations memorandum that details the plan for extended occupation of the nation of Libya. It envisions a long-term presence of police and or military from other nations and other regions. We are honored now to be joined by Matthew Russell Lee of the Inner City Press. Matthew, this is quite a scoop. I understand that governments around the world are asking you about it. Can you tell us what this document is, how you got it, and what it portends?
Sure. Thanks a lot. I'm not going to tell you entirely how I got it, but as close as I can. But what it is is that ever since the UN Security Council passed a resolution, it was called 1973, that basically just turned over operations to NATO for the bombing of Libya, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, took it upon himself to undertake a planning for what they called it post-transition. And in many questions, I'd say it's essentially post-Qaddafi Libya. And he brought on board a longtime UN official called Ian Martin from the United Kingdom. And basically, he set up a team. He got this professor from Dartmouth called Dirk van der Waal. And they started churning out, without really having any kind of mandate or oversight or accountability that I can see, churning out a plan for, quote, post-conflict Libya. And I started hearing, I do reporting here pretty closely, so I know people that were caught wind of the document. Some of them had seen it and not even been allowed to physically keep a copy because they didn't want the Ban Ki-moon team was very concerned about it leaking out. But it was finalized on August 22nd, and I started getting somebody read to me over the phone some quotes from it. We can get into the substance of it. And eventually, by nosing around, and I was able to get a copy last Thursday, and I put it online on Friday, and it's been. At first they tried to say it's not a UN document. Now they acknowledge it's an internal UN document, but it's pretty much of a kind of a final plan. And a lot of people, including countries, are asking themselves sort of by what authority did the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon sort of undertake this planning for Libya.
We're speaking with Matthew Lee of Inner City Press, based at the United Nations, on this document that refers to the Consolidated Report of the Integrated Pre-Assessment Process for Libya Post-Conflict Planning. What kind of military and or police or international occupation does this plan envision?
Sure. It talks about military advisors. It talks about UN police. It's actually, I've read it obviously a number of times before putting it online. I think that you can look at a country like the Democratic Republic of the Congo or Sudan, where the UN has 20,000 peacekeepers. Let's say, these are some large missions. This is sort of a I'm not really sure what they're thinking. I know Ian Martin, but he's refused to answer any questions about this. But the numbers that are used in this document, and it would be sort of I think the UN viewed this as an initial deployment, is 190, up to 200 military observers, 190 UN police, some other untold number of civilian staffers, including planning for elections. It actually. In covering the UN this way, it may not be quite as macabre as some see it. It's kind of a self-justifying machine, i.e. different parts of the UN system said, hey, we can get involved. There's something called the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. They want to be there. UNDP wants to be there. It's kind of like a new gold rush in which there's a nation building to be done. And the one thing I want to be sure to put out there is that it's not just sort of like the UN wanting to sort of make a role for itself or make itself relevant. It's that the UN is it's made up of member states, and so just as this planning seems to some, certainly in the UN's Department of Political Affairs, to be very kind of Western aligned. It talks about an ongoing NATO presence in the country. It talks about the IMF having a big role in economics. These same countries that have sort of dominated the planning would be expected to dominate the staffing of this. And even if that's just a jobs program, or maybe it's a, something a little bit more macabre, which could be intelligence gathering, it's the whole thing is just totally unaccountable, I guess would be what it seems to me, and I'm happy to have gotten it and put it online.
You mentioned the date, the closing date of this document as the 22nd of August. As I recall, that was the day that a group of global leaders simultaneously came forward with announcements that the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya is over. That simultaneity, along with the conjunction of the completion date of this document, it seems quite significant. Does that suggest to you that the planning contained therein is already underway?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. I think that the you can, there's other things in the document, too, that point totally that way, which is that, for example, there's a reference to, you know, getting over any possible hurdle of, quote, unfreezing assets. And whatever, I mean, I try to, you know, step back. I cover the Security Council, so I can tell you that last week there was a big fight in the Security Council between the United States and South Africa on whether money frozen in the United States could be turned over to the transition, they're calling it now the NTC instead of the TNC, the National Transitional Council. And South Africa said since the AU hadn't yet, African Union hadn't recognized the National Transitional Council, it couldn't go by that name. The U.S. threatened to call a vote. Eventually, they compromised on using the word relevant authorities. But this document, instead of saying there are two views out there, South Africa's and the United States, it just adopts the U.S. view and says we've got to just unfreeze. And so that's, I mean, I think that's, I'm trying to characterize why, the, what sort of what, including, you know, some ambassadors that I've been speaking to about the document, what they see is wrong with this, that it doesn't, the UN really, even, you know, obviously there's a variety of views, but the UN in its planning should say, like, you know, here's two, here's various possibilities, or here's two different views, whereas in this planning it seems pretty clear, you know, who's having the input and which side of the debate they think is going to win. Not forgetting even for a moment of like whether they should. I mean, it does offer some praise. There's two separate documents actually, Robert. There's the hot one is this one, the Ian Martin report, 10 pages planning. There's also a longer document that's called the Van der Waal report, which is this professor at Dartmouth, Dirk Van der Waal. And that's actually kind of an interesting document because he's a Libya expert brought on as a consultant to the UN, and he actually praises the health and education systems under Gaddafi. He notes that the rebels committed some atrocities and used child soldiers. It's a weird document which you'd expect out of a professor, and I'm not really sure, you know, the UN just was sort of happy and proud to have an expert, but it didn't fully inform the planning that they've come out with.
One of the things we've been covering here, Matthew Lee, is the a clandestine involvement of many nations in the operations in Libya. We are aware of the United States Special Forces, of the SAS, of the French Foreign Legion, or various designations of military advisors there. But one of the things by which we were taken is the extreme leadership role that is being played by troops from Qatar and Jordan, but particularly Qatar, yep, that quickly engaged in the bombing. This document says at one point, additional unarmed NATO military officers or officials from Arabic-speaking countries have been requested to provide the remaining officers needed. Can you shed some light on this new growing Qatari and or Jordanian and or Arab military special operations complex?
Sure. No, I mean, it is the same kind of rush to find Arab allies took place, you know, as soon as that resolution 1973 was passed. They had to, as sort of ground cover, there was an outreach to the UAE to get them to say they were going to fly sorties, obviously Qatar. So I agree with you. I mean, I guess some of the dispute here is from the West point of view, it's like this is sort of ground cover. From their point of view, it's I mean, if you've noticed, it's kind of the real gold rush in Libya is like, who's going to get the oil contracts? You have Italy getting back in there, France. So I think that Qatar really took a you could call it a leadership, or you could call it an out in front role in helping the rebels export some oil, unfreeze some assets. So I think, I mean, there's also a discussion here, and again, this is what's wrong with the UN. It says like two member states have been provided with the plan, and we're waiting for their response. I mean, who's the UN to choose sort of to come up with a confidential plan for a country and share it with two countries? I mean, even before I got the document, every day here there's like a noon press briefing, and I was asking them like, this plan, are you going to release it to the public? Are you going to release it to the Libyan people? Are you releasing it to, I mean, the UN is owned by its member states, so either you release it to all the member states or to none, but you can't release it to two. But that's how they've approached it.
Whom do you suspect were the recipients?
I'm trying to be, you know, ruthlessly factual here, but France is one of the in terms of the two countries. I'm jumping past the. There's one reference to Arabic-speaking police, and then there's two countries for sort of ongoing peacekeepers. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, you know, during the conflict, France was very upfront in terms of they pretty much acknowledged, you know, airdropping weapons into the Nafusa Mountains, which totally violated the resolution. The resolution said there's an arms embargo on the entire country. And then France basically dropped the weapons and then came up with an interpretation that because they weren't to protect civilians, they were protecting civilians, but in fact they were dropping them by parachute, so the guns could go to anyone. They've been pretty upfront, so I'd throw that. And there's a country, not of the two that you've named, that borders Syria, that's becoming more of a, I guess, just sees which side the bread is buttered on. The one thing I'd say about Jordan, I just wanted, because I remember you mentioned that, alongside Ian Martin was Ban Ki-moon's kind of envoy just to purportedly try to mediate between Gaddafi and the rebels, was this guy Al-Khatib. And when he was named, it was sort of right after the resolution, and Ban Ki-moon was casting around to try to, like, be relevant and have an envoy. And he named this guy, and it turned out that this guy is a sitting senator in Jordan. And so, you know, being, you know, something of a stickler, the UN can't really have people that work for it and a government, at least, you know, officially at the same time. So then they ended up, first they, you know, they sort of denied this, and then they tried to say, well, his contract is not yet finalized. Finally, they said he's not getting any money from the UN, so it's okay to be a UN mediator and also a sitting politician in a country that has its own protest movement. You know what I mean? Like, what some people here said is that it's kind of hypocritical to send a guy who's on the side of a government that at that time, at least in some level, is shooting at protesters in the street, and he's going to go and mediate and sort of pontificate about somebody else's problem. But as it turns out, obviously his mediation wasn't that successful because there was no agreement was reached, and he seems to be getting sort of pushed out of the process by the UN.
We're speaking with Matthew Lee of the Inner City Press, based at the United Nations, on his revelation of an internal United Nations document that envisions an ongoing occupation of the nation of Libya. Now, the front end of this refers to a couple of hundred unarmed United Nations military observers, but it goes on to attempt mission creep, as it were, that the tasks of monitoring withdrawals and movements and weapon storage would have to be adapted for the specific case of Libya as it has developed. I want you to address that, but let me present you also with the money question.
Sure.
The United Nations involvement may not be the only one envisioned. Paragraph 7 says, the Security Council was informed that if an interim protection force is required to enable this deployment of the unarmed United Nations military observers, given the time needed for the UN to generate and deploy troops, such a presence would have to come, if requested by the Libyans and authorized by the Council, it would have to come from some other source, such as a multinational force under a lead nation command. Now, does that mean European nations are standing by to serve?
No, that's a great, that's one of the key paragraphs. It's actually just after what you read is where it talks about two member states have been provided with the force requirements. And I think this is true. This is one of the more troubling paragraphs in it because, you know, definitely, you know, this idea of a multinational force, essentially that's like what the, what the U.S. did in Iraq, what ISAF, quote unquote, is doing in Afghanistan. It's basically the U.N., you know, under international law, such as it is, these type of occupations are only legal if authorized by the Council. But then the new, you know, the new groove is to simply hand the UN's legitimacy and the blue flag over to a coalition of the willing. So, I mean, and this is this reference to two member states where I was surmising that one of them is France. This has yet to be, I mean, this is why I want to distinguish me saying that that's what I think from the document being a factual thing, you know?
Absolutely.
But obviously, I think that's one of the things that's really also caught some of the ambassadors over here's eye is sort of like, you know, there was a big fight at the time of the resolution authorizing the airstrikes to say the Arab League at that time sort of called for a no-fly zone, but wanted to make it very clear that they weren't authorizing any kind of an occupation. So there was a no foreign no foreign presence, no foreign boots on the ground, which, you know, it seems like was violated by at least some trainers, if not more. But this is definitely, it's sort of like the UN just jumps over that whole concern and says, hey, you know, this is what, you know, they're already approaching member states to do it. There's a, there's another line I just want to direct you to where they, this is the one that, that really sort of jumped out at people. It's in paragraph 8. It says, the Security Council's, quote, protection of civilians mandate implemented by NATO does not end with the fall of the Gaddafi government, and therefore NATO would continue to have some responsibilities. That's a pretty, it's not clear that that's the case. I mean, there's different views on that. And the idea that the UN Secretariat, which is supposed to be even-handed in between the sort of different points of view on that, would just say outright NATO has a role is a big problem.
Sometimes one may suspect that UN could also stand for United NATO.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's exactly, and it's, I mean, I'll just give you another example of this, is that in the tail end of the conflict where NATO pretty much intentionally bombed Libyan state television, you know, questions were, there was a whole Security Council session meeting. Again, all these things are behind closed doors, so you have to, like, be in front of it and talk to the various ambassadors and get to the bottom of it, but it turned out, and I learned, that what was taking place in the closed-door meeting was questions by a number of states of how NATO bombing a TV station was part of a protection of civilians mandate, you know, unless bad TV is a threat to civilians. That was the joke at the time. But they ended up, they sort of vaguely said, well, it, you know, it was hate TV. It was like Radio Milcolin in Rwanda. But no one had really made that case. It basically was like, you know, NATO was trying to, you know, to oust one government and put in another. And to do that, they bombed everywhere they could. And so the problem with this is exactly where the UN Secretary General was supposed to step in. And not to be, I'm not an enormous fan of Kofi Annan, but I will, you know, people may remember, this is before I was covering the UN, but it was, you know, when the U.S. went into Iraq, Kofi Annan said, this is illegal under international law. The current Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, basically, he was charged under this resolution with sort of overseeing or in some way safeguarding the operation to keep it consistent with protection of civilians. And he just totally abdicated. I asked at a briefing, does the Secretary General think that bombing, you know, state TV is protection of civilians? And they said, well, that's really up to NATO. I mean, it's like, it's not up to NATO. Maybe it was an honest answer, but it's the planning is kind of consistent with this just total, you know, it's just either being buffeted in the wind or more likely you being dominated by one side of the debate. The real question here is not so much, I think, what Russia or China or other countries on the council, South Africa, India, what they think of this document. I mean, it's sort of like, it's hard to say what do the Libyan people think, but I think anybody would say the UN is not supposed to be planning for people without their consent. It's just not what's supposed to happen.
Our guest is Matthew Lee of the Inner City Press, a great revelation from them at the United Nations plans for the ongoing occupation of Libya. You referred to South Africa before, and I'd like to follow up on that element of things in the Security Council. South Africa actually voted for this gaping wide door of a resolution 1973, Security Council 73 and 1970, and now belatedly seems to be opposing the escalation of the overthrow and the occupation. Can you help us understand why South Africa would have voted for that invasion in the first place, and what they're trying to triangulate now?
Yeah, no, I agree. People were pretty surprised, and there was there was discussion at the time. I was covering it the day of that vote, and it was down to the wire of, one, whether Russia and China, which have vetoes, would veto the resolution, and two, whether the U.S. would get if there wasn't a veto, the minimum of 9. So there was a lot of, I really think this went to the highest levels. Apparently, you know, the Obama administration or Obama himself called Jacob Zuma. And there was then a very, I thought, kind of cheesy article in the New York Times claiming that Ambassador Susan Rice had sort of frog marched the South African ambassador, Basso Sankyu, in and made him vote in a certain way. But it was, something took place. And I think that's, I mean, you were saying, you know, I do the best I can in terms of getting documents, but someone really needs to make a sort of a definitive, to reach a definitive knowledge of why that happened that way. I think that, you know, since then, I mean, for example, not to, you know, either to the credit or whatever, just objectively, South Africa on this most recent unfreezing of $1.5 billion was the only country that said there's a problem with just releasing this to the National Transitional Council. They said, we haven't recognized them as the government yet. The Security Council has. You can't do it. Other ones, even Russia and China, were like, let it go. I think that they're, you know, there's a lot of realpolitik around. And so the Russia and China, they see, like, it's already gone. Like, Gaddafi is hiding underground. His family members today fled into Algeria. So they've just sort of, most of their focus right now at the UN is on Syria and not, from their point of view, having the same thing happen there. Whereas South Africa, I guess, maybe it's a domestic thing. They fell under some questioning for having, you know, for what they did earlier on, and now they've become the kind of you know, there's also a lot of people that say Gaddafi was a big supporter of the African Union. There's a pretty good analysis of sort of investments that Gaddafi made in Africa. So it's true, though. Their policy really looks kind of incoherent. You know, they were sort of, at the time that the position they're now taking might have made a difference, they didn't take it, and now that it's, you know, objectively pretty late in the game, you know, from their point of view, they were just trying to set the, you know, keep it clear that the National Transitional Council hadn't been recognized yet. But they got pretty isolated. They were the only, they weren't able to get, you know, other countries on their side, including India and Brazil, who now make up a kind of a bloc in the Security Council. You have these IBSA countries, but I mean, it was surprising that they were out on a limb.
Matthew Lee, I know you have another perhaps intriguing appointment coming up, but I'd like to ask you, what do you see flowing from the aftermath of this? Will there be a different kind of resistance to military occupation and the various forms of opportunism that are to be had in Libya? As you yourself have reported, the African Union was cut out of this document, not envisioned in it. Yep. Will the behavior of cavalier voting for military involvements and escalations through the Security Council and the UN in general, do you see any change from the libertine ways of military involvement that have been conducted so far?
Yeah, I know. That's a really good question. I mean, I mentioned Syria. I don't want to sort of move on to the next conflict, but that's right now, that's like the real hot sort of hot topic. And you have, you know, right now there's a pending resolution suggested, which doesn't envision military action, but then, you know, what the skeptics say is that either did the first Libya resolution, 1970. So I think there's no question that the way it played out in Libya has led, at least now, some countries to be more resistant to giving a blank check to action. But the question is, how long does that last? And it was very surprising to people how things played out on Libya. It was sort of, you know, some people saw it as a kind of a euphoric time where countries that were portrayed as kind of sticks in the mud suddenly either voted for or abstained, and these things took place. It's never been sort of, I mean, I guess what we can say is that Gaddafi really, when push came to shove, he didn't have the allies that, for example, Bashar al-Assad seems to have. But the what role sort of like, what the Western countries on the council seem to think is that, okay, they'll put forward a resolution on Syria, they'll leave it on the table, they'll sort of, you know, try to make India, South Africa, and Brazil, you know, look like human rights, you know, bad actors for not voting for it, and that at some point there'll be such graphic footage from Syria that Russia and China will at least abstain and they'll push something through. That seems to be their strategy. I don't know, you know, that's what makes, it doesn't feel like right now like that would work, but I'll actually throw this out to you. I think that the Syria thing may not even go through the Security Council. You have some mostly kind of Sunni countries in the region that are beating the drum about protection of civilians, setting up of humanitarian corridors. And it's just like the U.S. did in Iraq, it's not entirely clear that those countries would wait or feel that they needed Security Council approval for that.
Well, Matthew Lee, we're going to speak about this for quite some time to come, and I invite you back any time you have such revelations for us. And we will follow up on this particular document about Libyan occupation. Definitely. In the future. But take a moment to tell people about Inner City Press, what you and your colleagues do, and give us the final thought.
Okay, sure. I mean, actually, it's been something of an evolution. Inner City Press has been banging around in New York for some time, actually, initially with the sort of homesteading in the South Bronx, and then it covering banks and redlining issues. Still does, actually, that. But so for the last few years, been covering, at the UN, covering, I guess you could say, international affairs and other stuff. And it's innercitypress.com, the sort of banking and fair banking and homesteading side is on innercitypress.org. And it's to me, it's been sometimes people ask, like, how did one lead to the other? But it was been kind of a seamless seamless transition. And it's fun. It's one thing about covering the UN is that it's really, it's like something like this document. You'd think like you'd need a huge media organization, and you do have some. I mean, you have some here, but it really comes down to kind of like, you know, you get to know people, and they come to trust you, and think that this is if they see something wrong going on, and they want to blow the whistle. I mean, I ask myself, like, why could I get this document somebody else couldn't? I don't want to read too much into it, but the people that felt disgruntled about it felt that something could happen this way, and maybe didn't trust other media in the same way. So it's really every day is exciting, although also troubling over here. So it's innercitypress.com, and Twitter innercitypress, just innercitypress. You could pretty much find it.
And for observers of the international machinations, your final word?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's more. Don't sort of believe the kind of, the wire services will put out sort of an end-of-the-day story saying the trend at the UN is this. But there's a lot of back and forth, and I actually think that people, not just, people in the U.S. in terms of impacting the U.S. mission to the UN or the Obama administration, I don't want to be naive. There are big powers at play here, but because, the sort of nitty-gritty votes that take place here, there's not that many people watching them. I think that people, shouldn't be entirely dispirited. It's worth following them, and I mean, I'll even say and trying to do what you can to have some impact on them.
Matthew Lee of the news agency Inner City Press, based at the United Nations, and the investigative reporter who brought us a document on the internal UN plans for the ongoing occupation of Libya. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. My name is Robert Knight. You're tuned to WBAI and or the Pacifica Radio Network. And one of the more curious points made on that fateful day, the 22nd of August, 2011, was made by President Obama. We brought our listeners' attention to it on that day, in which he made a very cryptic statement about further United States involvement in Libya beyond the coordination of the NATO bombing, the drone strikes, and all of the military and clandestine operations. Here is just a brief excerpt from that speech in which President Obama hints at future involvements in Libya, perhaps not unrelated to this United Nations document on post-conflict deployment in Libya. Here now, President Obama from the 22nd of August.
As we move forward from this pivotal phase, the opposition should continue to take important steps to bring about a transition that is peaceful, inclusive, and just. As the leadership of the TNC has made clear, the rights of all Libyans must be respected. True justice will not come from reprisals and violence. It will come from reconciliation and a Libya that allows its citizens to determine their own destiny. In that effort, the United States will be a friend and a partner. We will join with allies and partners to continue the work of safeguarding the people of Libya. As remaining regime elements menace parts of the country, I've directed my team to be in close contact with NATO as well as the United Nations to determine other steps that we can take. To deal with the humanitarian impact, we're working to ensure that critical supplies reach those in need, particularly those who've been wounded. Secretary Clinton spoke today with her counterparts from leading nations of the coalition on all these matters, and I've directed Ambassador Susan Rice to request that the UN Secretary General use next month's General Assembly to support this important transition. For many months, the TNC has been working with the international community to prepare for a post-Gaddafi Libya.
President Barack Obama speaking about other steps we can take in Libya. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow with engineering by Michael G. Haskins. We invite your comments at theshadow, theshadow, at wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York. Thank you for listening.
Summer rain taps at my window, west wind soft as a sweet dream. My love warm as the sunshine, sitting here by me.